Sure.
I usually say the number one mistake that people make when they reach out to agents is you just have to remember that agents are really, really busy, just like everyone else. And if you send them a book to read, you know, over email, and they're in the gauntlet zone of like grinding and like a long day or on a conference call, you just have to think about it from their perspective. Mm-hmm. You may not have any interest from like a record label or a manager yet, but maybe you're drawing tickets, right? That's where I would say just reach out to them. You know, like a lot of them won't respond, of course, but like some of the best emails I've ever seen have been like, "Hey Daniel, I love your roster. We sound a lot like grandson. We just sold out our hometown. Here's our upcoming demo that's not released yet." I don't really need to know that much more from them.
This episode is brought to you by DistroKid. DistroKid is a distribution service that can get your music into all the DSPs like Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram. Over a million artists have used DistroKid. I'm one of those artists. I've used DistroKid to get my music out, distribute some of my songs. As you know, as I look into all of these distribution services, I test them out. And DistroKid is great. They offer a ton of features, annual fee, unlimited uploads, and you keep 100% of your royalties. Check out DistroKid.com. What's going on? Welcome to the New Music Business. I'm your host, Ari Hirstand, author of How to Make It in the New Music Business, the book. Third edition is out now everywhere, all formats, audio, physical hardcover, ebook, however you do the book thing, you can find it. Today, my guest is Daniel McCartney. He is a booking agent at UTA. His artists include Grandson and Mothica, who is also on the show, Modson, many others. He's also the founder of Outlast Records, which is a record label, an imprint of Sumerian Records. And he's also the co-founder of the Continuance Foundation, which is their tagline is, well, they say they're provide community resources, counseling, coaching, and education for musicians and the music industry to improve their mental health. And that's what we kind of got started discussing for a little bit today. You know, mental health is so crucial and important in the industry, and I don't think we talk about it enough. So I'm always looking for people that are specializing in this, that are focusing on it, that are providing resources to the industry at large. And I think that's really important and really crucial. And so I really appreciate what Daniel has been doing with the foundation. And we talk all about the resources that they provide and how you can get access to them. It was a great conversation. And then we also spent quite a bit of time on the state of the live music industry, the touring industry right now. We talk a lot about support tours and how to get on them, the ranges of what people are paying for support tours from all level, from clubs all the way up to arenas, you know, how to make money on the road. Daniel breaks down a lot of different ways that artists are making money and the difference between a losing tour and a winning tour. He talks all about that. He talks about, you know, what to do to make sure that your tours are profitable. And he gives some really great practical advice. And we even talk about, you know, how to break out of your hometown, because Daniel, what's so cool is he started as a musician. And this is something that I really appreciate, his musician's empathy and kind of where he came from as the guitarist. He actually started as the guitarist of the metalcore band Gideon. So many of you are probably familiar with Gideon. So he started as the guitarist of that band. And now he is an industry executive. And a lot of the stuff that we discussed, we put in the show notes. So a lot of the links to the resources and all of that. So check that out. You can find Daniel McCartney and UTA and the Continuance Foundation on all the socials. He said they're very active, the Continuance Foundation, on their social media. So definitely check them out, their Instagram. And Outlast Records, and they're very active as well on their social media. So check them out on the socials. You can find all of us that make the show happen at Ari's Take on Instagram and TikTok. We are on Threads and Twitter as well. I'm not really sure what's happening with Threads and Twitter these days. So, you know, you can find us there too, but we're most active on Instagram and TikTok. You can find me at Ari Herstand on Instagram. And visit aristake.com and get on the email list. That's where you're going to find the most up-to-date relevant info that we send out there. But real quick, if you just pause this, hit the subscribe, hit the follow button. That would really that really helps. If you want the show to follow, you know, pop up in your feed, hit the subscribe, hit the follow button, and we'll show up there. And leave us a 5-star review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or however you're listening to this. If it's on YouTube, click that thumbs up. Leave us a comment. I love reading those. And stay in touch. All right, let's kick into the show. Daniel McCartney, welcome to the show.
Man, thanks for having me. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Course. So I'm excited to talk to you today. You wear many different hats in the industry, and I love that you started as an artist. If I got this right, you're the guitarist in the metalcore group Gideon. You know, mm-hmm. It's kind of to have that artist empathy and that artist perspective, I think, is so crucial and you know, missing from a lot of industry people oftentimes, and like, to have that empathy, I think, is really important. But also, you know, as kind of a label founder and, of course, as a booking agent at UTA, a massive booking agency, repping some great clients. But I do want to start off today by talking about something that I believe you started just a couple years ago, and I'd love to hear the journey in starting the Continuance Foundation and kind of your focus on mental health, because I think it is something so needed in the industry. And it's, you know, for some reason, the music industry seems that that we struggle with mental health more than most other industries. At least that's my perception. Top to bottom, left to right, from, you know, the highest level executives down to the artists. And, you know, we often hear about the high profile artists that have, you know, cancel tours, and they get a lot of the press because they're names that we know of. And, you know, a lot, you know, of course, Justin Bieber was like famously discussed having to cancel his tours. And but artists of all levels have mentioned that. But what gets reported far less, I think, is the industry executives and everyone that works in the industry. And for some reason, our industry struggles with this so much. So I'm really glad to hear that you have been focusing on this. And I'd love to hear your perspective on kind of how you came to this and what you're working on.
Yeah, man. Well, first off, thank you for having me. You know, I always say, like, anyone that has the subject of mental health, you know, close to their heart, you kind of, you know, I think that you kind of get into a zone where once you're feeling better, and, you know, you're in a bit of a routine in the way that you're dealing with your mental health, you typically want to talk about it, right? And so these platforms are so important. You know, the podcasting, the Instagram lives, like all this stuff, it might seem easy, but it's just so impactful. So thank you. And yeah, look, being an artist, yeah. You know, it still is probably my biggest pitch when I'm in a room trying to sign a client, you know, is that I was able to, you know, I toured full time and put out 4 records and, toured internationally, domestically, and dealt with record labels and publishers and all this stuff. And, it's been really good experience. I think, like, you know, a lot of artists would just want their team to not be robotic. And I think that I was able to kind of like bypass coming off as someone that is robotic or like a, no, you know, I mean, honestly, man, like there are a lot of agents that, you know, they're not going to do anything above what they're required, and that's totally okay as long as they're getting their job done. However, you know, I'm a little different. I'm a little bit more hands-on. That comes from me kind of having a little bit more knowledge in some of the other spaces that aren't even necessarily the agent's, you know, what the agent's supposed to be doing or the agent's responsibility. So that's been great. Yeah. And, you know, I'm the founder of a record label called Outlast Records, which is under Sumerian Music Group. You know, that's a bit of a passion project and I've got, some really cool developmental acts on that. And then very, you know, all things mental health. You know, I speak at conferences. I do all the, you know, I do the Instagram series, we do podcasting, we do all this different stuff. And, you know, all of it really comes down to the goal of, you know, helping people and advocating for the mental health subject, and also trying to connect people to get them in with professionals if they need it. And if they just need support, you know, we're very, very active on social networks. So it's been fun, man. I mean, look, you know, I basically made this foundation as something that I kind of wish that I would have had when I was a musician. And that's why it's almost been, you know, when people ask me, you know, how did you start it? I'm like, I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. Just being honest, I just kind of jumped right in as someone who's like, all right, well, I know what my needs were, and you know, let's start there. You know what I mean? And we were able to kind of blossom it into a cool thing and do a lot of great work. So it's been a long journey, a fun one.
Yeah, no, that's great to hear, and it's nice to hear your story and the journey. However you want to take this, but specifically, I'd like to know if there are musicians or even industry executives or anyone working in the industry out there who are kind of interested in seeking out more resources or in need of more resources, whether that be, you know, mental health professionals, you know, therapists, or anyone potentially even more serious. You mentioned that you provide some resources or anything like that. But even outside, you know, theoretically, the Continuance Foundation network, what do you recommend? Like, if there are people listening right now, they're like, you know, I just don't know where to turn. I'm not really sure what to do. And maybe I can't afford a therapist or something because it'd be expensive. Like, what are the first steps and kind of like, what do you offer? How do you point people? Where do you point them?
Well, look, I think it's a great question. And the first thing I would say is, you know, reach out for help, right? Like it's a simple thing, but also when I think us as people were kind of designed to be that if we can't handle something for ourselves, we think, oh, well, you know, I just don't know how to do this or whatever. But you got to remember that there are so many people that care about this subject and have the resources that they can plug you in with. Right. So even if it's down to like referrals or like, obviously, you know, therapy is, I live and die by it. I love it. I go once a week. It saved my life for sure. Not everyone can afford therapy. It's not that simple. Sometimes, some health insurance, providers don't cover therapy. However, there's a ton of great organizations that will refer you. You know, you got Backline, you've got Continuance, you got Music Cares. There's a lot of really, really good organizations that they may not be able to just write a check for your therapy, but they might be able to get, you know, for example, Continuance Foundation, we have a partnership with BetterHelp. So no matter what, we can get them plugged in with a certain amount months free of therapy. You know, we can't always just
Can you explain what BetterHelp is?
Yeah, BetterHelp is like a network that it's kind of like, I don't know if you personally have ever gone through the process of like going into your health insurance provider and like going into the portal and looking for a therapist. It's really daunting. And it's like, there's nothing easy about it. And you literally just don't know what you're doing. You might as well just pick a name off of a list. BetterHelp is a more of a platform that connects you. It's really, really user friendly. And it's just a way more attainable platform and app. So we partner with them and we're able to immediately get people into free therapy from the jump. And obviously we vet the therapists and we know that they're fully capable of doing their job. And so you just kind of never know how someone's going to be able to help, you know, and you got to ask when you're in need, because literally there's not a single person on this planet that hasn't gone through something or, you know, had their own shit and needed someone else to help them. Right. So I think that that's a big part of it.
Yes. Absolutely. And that's, you know, you mentioned Backline, which we had Hillary Gleason from Backline on the show last year. And in Music Cares, we've partnered with them in the past, and they're a great organization that if people don't know about Music Cares, it's from the Recording Academy. It's kind of an organization within the Recording Academy that provides financial assistance to musicians in need. And it can be anything from medical bills. If there are medical bills, you can apply. And I've heard of people that, you know, got into serious trouble and did not have health insurance and had tens of thousands of dollars of medical bills that Music Cares covered, or anything. I mean, honestly, they're just there to help, which financially, which is a great resource. And I'm glad you brought them up. And then similarly, Backline sounds very similar to what you're doing in kind of providing resources in terms of like therapists or, you know, well, vetted therapists, which I think is really important. And then you mentioned that you've partnered with BetterHelp and also to help provide a free or discounted therapy. How do you go about that? Do you have grants or do you have people that are kind of funding this, or are they donating their time, or how does this work?
Well, luckily, BetterHelp is a company that they really are prioritizing, I think, giving quality therapy. So they just believe in our mission. And so most of the time what will happen is we'll get, you know, from the jump, you can usually get at least 3 months for free for the musician. Mm-hmm. The thing is not everyone wants to go to therapy permanently. I'm a permanent therapy guy. Like I'll probably have a therapist until the day I died. It works for me. Not everyone needs it that way though. So like 3 months is a good time, I think, too, if you're grieving or you're going through something specific. I think it's a good kind of time period of, you know, you get, let's say you do 4 sessions a month, you know, 12 sessions to really kind of dig deep. And if they need more, usually we can accommodate. So that's been a really, I mean, that's been a really great resource for us to have. It's just been so, it's also very, very swift because we literally just give them the code that we have. And, you know, if you're in a bad spot and you're asking for a therapist, you know, usually any type of effort that is required is kind of brutal. You know what I mean? It's kind of one of those things where you're not really in a spot to take on a bunch of, you know, to-do lists to be able to get that. So for us to be able to do it quickly and swiftly is a big part of it too.
That's awesome. Well, that's great. And for those that are kind of, you know, interested in taking advantage of some of what you discussed, would it be just kind of, how do they go about this? How do they find you? How do they sign up for this?
Well, we're really good on our social networks. Our Instagram is Continue Always. And we also have a submission form on our website. Okay. So both of them, we have a small operation. So both of them go to like 3 people that will definitely actually read it and definitely respond. So, and then, like I said, like just by following our social networks alone, there's so much great content. We do Mindfulness Mondays. We do a Conversations About Mental Health series. I'm always doing podcasts. We post all the reels from there. You know, if I ever speak at an event, it'll be on the information will be on there. And we really just try to like actually engage with the people who are following it.
Great. Cool. And we'll put links to all of that, what you discussed in the show notes so people can find it. Sick. Awesome. I also want to talk about kind of your role as a booking agent. You know, you've been a booking agent. How long have you been a booking agent at UTA?
So I started at UTA 8 years ago. And I was, I think about 3 of those years, I was an assistant. And then got promoted, had about, you know, 2 years of starting to build my roster. And then the pandemic happened and kind of threw it all for a whirl. But yeah, I've been at the company for 8 years.
Okay. Awesome. And I read somewhere you're booking artists like Grandson, Mothica, who was also on the podcast, and Mod Sun. Now, I'm curious about when you, I guess I'd love to kind of talk about the state of touring, where we're at right now. You know, we are talking August 2023. A lot has shifted, a lot has changed. But if you could kind of point out some of the biggest changes, I would say maybe since COVID, or maybe everything's back to normal. So I don't want to kind of guide you in any one direction, but I'm curious what your perception is of the state of the live music industry is right now.
Yeah, so it's a great question. So it's funny because like right when touring came back after the pandemic, it was kind of a honeymoon phase, yeah. Right? It was like, it was almost unrealistic. Like everything was just crushing. Like shows, we put a show on sale and it would just sell out like this. Tours were absolutely crushing. And that's because it was, everyone was pent up for years and it made total sense from like a, you know, psychological aspect. It made total sense. And then it kind of got, you know, pounded into the ground and it was a little too much. Right. Yep. And then tours were terrible for like 4 or 5 months. It was the touring economy was in a really bad spot. A lot of stuff wasn't selling. Festivals were being pulled down. Now I think we're at a spot where it's evened out. And I even think that this is probably one of the biggest years for touring in a long time. I mean, you know, Drake and Taylor Swift obviously out right now is, I mean, it's literally boosting our economy. So
right.
I think now we're in a really good spot. You know, there's some changes, I think. Like, I think, you know, we're more equipped to deal with, you know, hopefully we don't ever have to deal with it again, but we're more equipped to deal with something like a pandemic where, you know, I think the music industry has learned a lot from even, you know, talk about, you know, some of the things that can really affect touring as, you know, a pandemic, you know, weather in some capacities. Terrorism is, you know, obviously with like, you know, the Ariana Grande bombing, and, you know, we've seen it and obviously in other live events, obviously with Eagles of Death Metal in Paris. And I think when these things happen, I feel like the music industry is doing their best to really bounce back from it. You know, I mean, the security is up from a lot of those incidents, obviously. Clear bag policies are really, really important in arenas and stadiums. So look, I think it's been a long ride, but I'm grateful to now kind of be in a consistent spot. It's just funny. My boss the other day was like, this is like the first time in your career that you've been operating as an agent and not like extreme circumstances. And I was like, that's so crazy to think about. It's been like a pandemic and then, it's just, it's been wild. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. So let's talk, I want to get in the weeds a little bit more. You know, we had Tom Windisch on the show not too long ago, who, of course, is Billie Eilish's agent and very high up at Wasserman and has been in the industry for decades. And, you know, he spoke kind of more on that higher level, you know, he books arenas and stadiums and stuff. He also books some clubs. But this was still like 6 months ago. And I'm curious from your perspective, working primarily with, you know, if I'm not mistaken, kind of club level touring artists. What are you seeing in terms of guarantees versus, you know, ticket splits versus merch cuts? You know, where's the revenue coming from right now? And has it, is it like, as you say, normal times? Is it normal? Are you seeing that kind of just, we're, you know, people are attending shows at the normal levels, and step me through kind of all of that and how it's operating kind of on this mid-level.
Yeah. I mean, look, yeah, most of my business is, you know, clubs, theaters, and ballrooms. So, you know, anywhere from 500 caps all the way up to 5,000, that's kind of my niche. Right. And Cool. I mean, the main source of income is coming from, you know, the box office, right? And selling tickets. So if you're selling tickets, if you're doing, you know, 80 to 100% business in the rooms, you know, so if it's 1,000 cap and you're doing at least 800 people to 1,000 people, most of the time everyone's making money in some capacity. You know, the box office definitely drives it. The promoter is able to, you know, we always like make jokes about this because, look, I mean, it's, you know, it's been hard for promoters to be able to keep their head above water post, you know, pre and post pandemic. A lot of them didn't, you know, a lot of them had to sell, and that's just what our timing, you know, that's, you know, the unfortunately the cards that a lot of them were dealt. However, you know, I think the venues and the promoters and, you know, the agents and the artists are all figuring out a lot of ways to make money. And, you know, VIP ticketing is really big, obviously, for meet and greets and upscale experiences. You know, a lot of bands, the really, really smart ones, they will make an absolute career out of their merchandise, both online and physical. I mean, I know artists who, you know, they'll literally break even on the guarantees, and then the merch is what, you know, sends them into like, you know, multi six figure net profit. So I think it's kind of, you know, every artist is different, but, you know, I think the core of it is driven by box office, and then the smart ones know how to build out the other parts of their business. Like I said, VIP ticketing and merchandise and stuff like that.
I love that you mentioned that, and I think it's so important. You know, I think a lot of artists, managers, even agents obsess over the guarantees and you know, what they're going to be making from attendance in the door and all of that at every level. So, you know, as an agent who doesn't, and correct me if I'm wrong, you don't participate in merch sales or do you participate in VIP packages?
We don't participate in merch. The VIP is a difficult question to answer because every situation is kind of different. Some VIP situations, you know, require a ton of bandwidth from the agent based on what company they're using or if the artist is doing, if the artist wants to keep all of the revenue from a VIP company standpoint instead of giving, you know, whatever VIP company their 20 or 25% or whatever they, you know, they negotiate. It depends. I would say more often than not, I don't commission the VIP stuff. I have, you know, because again, it depends on how much bandwidth it requires from me, you know?
Sure. Now that makes sense. Who are some, you know, if there are some, and I guess when do VIP companies and programs and packages come into play? You said you book rooms ranging from 500 to 5,000. Do you encourage your artists at every level to work a VIP program, or are you only focusing on the ones that are kind of at that upper echelon?
The short answer is I encourage everyone to do it because it just, it can make your, you can go from, you know, negative whatever on your budget to like walking away with a bunch of money just from doing it. And, you know, it really, really help you build a real career financially. The only sentence usually when I would like would steer away from it would be, this is a very specific example, but like, you know, if you're a really, really cool artist that like your fans are rooted in, maybe like, I'll just use Pigeons and Planes, for example, right? Obviously such a cool media outlet, news outlet, and brand, you know, it's not going to be advantageous for every artist in the world to do VIP meet and greets because it may not be cool to their fans that they're doing the meet and greets, and they might get some, they might get almost like some backlash. And, you know, I think, which I think is, you know, I think it's kind of silly, but you know, if you want to pay to meet your, you know, idol or one of your favorite artists, I think, you know, the artist should get paid for doing that. You know what I mean? So
yeah,
it really depends. I think like, you know, I would encourage from the club level all the way up, you know, I mean, once you get into arenas and stuff, it's kind of hard to pull off. But, you know, not every artist wants to do it at that point. But I think clubs all the way up to ballroom, usually I'm encouraging it.
Yeah, I encourage it too. And, you know, I wrote a piece for Variety a few months back when Matty Healy of the 1975 shit on VIP programs. And I thought that was a very entitled position. You know, they are touring arenas and they're extremely successful and extremely wealthy and come from privilege and come from wealth. You know, I've talked to a ton of indie touring bands. And like you just said today, you know, it can be the difference of a make or break financial tour. It can put you in the red or put you in the black. With a program, you're profitable. Without a program, you lose money and can't tour. And I think there's a way to do it that is respectful. And I've seen in that not just respectful, but in a way that it's not just like pay to meet your artists, but artists that I've seen, especially at the club level, do it really well. It's like, you know, you invite them to sound check and you have first access to merch and you get, you know, in early and you get like a souvenir lanyard and you do a Q&A and you have a special acoustic performance. And like that absolutely to me seems completely worth it. And doesn't seem like a money grab, and it doesn't seem like you're paying to meet them. It seems like you're paying artists for their time, and you actually get like another performance and other kind of special features and special packages based on that. And so, you know, I think if there's hesitation from any artist or manager listening to this, it's like I think go for it and just do it in a way that makes sense for you and your fans, you know, and don't. Maybe don't call it a meet and greet. Just call it, you know, call it something that's interesting. Call it a, you know, a VIP package or whatever. But I think there's definitely a way to do it that makes sense.
Yeah, look, dude. I mean, I'm a big 1975 fan, and I think Matt is obviously brilliant. But
too.
It's super easy to say. It's easy to say at that level, right? I think. It's all about how the artist really takes it by the, you know, takes the bull by the horns. Cause look, you know, if I were a fan and I walked in and I bought this extremely expensive meet and greet and someone walked up to me, you know, the singer said, hi, shakes my hand and then just pushes me and I got 6 seconds of his time. Yeah, sure. That's when it's ridiculous. And, that's when it's, you know, that is taking advantage of your fans. But look, you know, if you're a fan and you get to do the experience where you skip the line, you get a specific t-shirt that you can't even buy anywhere else. You get to watch them sound check. You get a photo with them. Like that's some of these people. These are like once in a lifetime experiences for them. And yeah, I have no problem with my clients
100%
charging a premium for that. I just, you know, I think it's cool.
Real quick, I want to let you know about Too Lost. Too Lost is a new distribution company to the space. And let me tell you, I am very impressed with them. I got a full deep dive demo with the founder. And yeah, they're very innovative. And when you come into the distribution space at this stage with how crowded it is, you better be innovative. And they are. Yes, they will get your music out to Spotify, Apple Music, all the places, plus 450 other outlets around the world. They do not take a commission. This is why 300,000 artists and labels have already used them. They've already distributed 7 million songs. They offer payment splitting, and they don't charge your collaborators for this service for the payment splitting. They will just pay your collaborators directly for free. They have publishing administration with BMG, so you know it's legit. A lot of distributors have fallen into trouble with using some other less than legit pub admin services. Well, Too Lost is partnered with BMG. You know it's legit. They offer instant royalty advances. This is something that's very cool. And if you have historical streaming data and you need just a bulk payment up front, they can see how much your music has earned in the past. I'm like, all right, we think we know what you're going to earn in the next 3 years. Here's a check for $100,000 or whatever it will be. And you can just click a button and get that distributed and into your account immediately. They do lyrics and credits distribution for free. They have a very innovative analytics platform where, yes, you will see real-time analytics for Spotify, Apple Music, but also Pandora, Deezer, SoundCloud, and Peloton. They're the only ones that do Peloton. They also have a service where you can search the internet wherever your music is being used, and it will just show you a chart of everywhere, every TikTok video, everywhere, every YouTube video, everywhere your music is possibly being used. I've never seen this before. That was very cool. They'll register you with SoundExchange, and they have a fraud prevention tool, and they're doing fraud prevention. So if you're worried about your music, you know, getting a bot attack or something like that and getting ripped down, which we've seen is a big issue, they have fraud prevention tools that are better than most other distributors that I have seen. Check out TooLost. You can just go to TooLost.com, use the promo code Ari's Take for 3 months free and try them out. Let them know what you think. Yeah. 100%. No, I love that. And it's nice to hear that reinforced. And similarly, I'm a huge 1975 fan. And I got so much backlash. I did not realize that their fan base was as hardcore as like the Swifties are, because man, did they pile on me on Twitter. Yeah. After that article came out, and I was like, guys, I have nothing bad to say about the music. And honestly, like, I, you know, everything else Maddie does is like, I think it's real interesting, and he's a brilliant, brilliant artist. But yes, I think when we're talking, you know, club level touring artists that are trying to survive on the road, I think that VIP needs to be part of the conversation.
Yeah. 100%, man.
So 100%. Yeah. Cool. So moving on, you know, I want to talk kind of support tours right now for a little bit. And, you know, I find some of the best ways for artists to gain new fans, especially ones that are amazing live, of course, is to be a support act on a tour and kind of win the headliner's fans over. How do you approach, I would say, you know, on one end, getting your artists as support acts on tours, and then on the flip side, for your headlining artists, what's the process of kind of getting the support acts for those tours as well?
Well, the industry standard is that, you know, you book the tour and then you send out an email, you know, going to all the different companies saying, hey, we're seeking support, you know, ideally someone worth 500 tickets. You know, here's our budget. Please submit. You know, we're looking to bring this type of genre act or whatever. It's not always that simple, but that's kind of like the standard, mm-hmm. I think, for it. And then, you know, obviously there are a lot of teams, sure, that they don't even send those emails. They keep it, you know, within their camps because they already know who they're going to take or whatever. Getting support tours is a grind, dude. You know, I mean, I always say once you become a headliner, never look back. You know, when I was trying to kind of develop Grandson into, you know, we just finished up a tour for him and that did 55,000 tickets in North America. So it was really successful. And in order for us to get to that, you know, we knew that we needed a support, and it surely was the death of me. But we got him Imagine Dragons. He did that in arenas. We got him Avril Lavigne in arenas in Canada, and then I got him Bring Me the Horizon here in the U.S. And the next time we went on the road, it was a clear return on investment. You know, I mean, he didn't make much money on those tours. You know, they weren't his. Sure. You know, he wasn't having insane sets because, again, these are people that, you know, you have a small window to gain a fan. You know, and you're trying to make someone who's a big fan of Bring Me the Horizon become a fan that actually goes and follows you on Instagram, maybe buys merch, adds, you know, your songs to the playlist, their Spotify playlist. I mean, you know, you have a small window to be able to do that. And the good thing about it is when you send a client out there that you know is just going to like slam dunk it, it's a good feeling because you can see it return for you pretty quickly.
Totally. That's a great case study and story. Let's talk about the financial aspect of it. when you said that when they went out with these huge acts and they didn't make much money on that, I mean, what is kind of why didn't they make much money? Is that just because, like, how does this work? And just for, you know, let's break it down for those that don't really know. What are we seeing in terms of, like, is there an industry standard for guarantees at various levels? Like, what are you seeing for support acts at, you know, club level, theater level, ballroom level, arena level, all of that? Like, how do the financials work typically, and travel and lodging and all of that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, the short answer is that, you know, if you go on a tour like Imagine Dragons, who is just a massively successful artist, and the agent is a very close friend of mine. She's amazing. If you go out on a tour, I mean, Imagine Dragons doesn't need you to draw tickets for them. You know, it's right. You know, you're in a situation there where, you know, you, if you're Imagine Dragons, you just want to take someone that's cool. You know, you want to take someone that you believe in, maybe you want to co-sign or whatever the scenario is. Now, if you have some leverage in that you are worth tickets and you want to go on tour with someone who is worth more tickets, but maybe not a ton more than you, that's a different scenario. I mean, that's where you get into, like, really negotiating a good deal for the client. But look, on the big scale of, you know, if you're supporting, you know, these arena acts, I've had, you know, people support, you know, Fall Out Boy, 21 Pilots, Blink-182, Imagine Dragons, you know, Avril Lavigne. I've had acts on all of those tours, and those acts are career acts with really, really impressive careers, who they, you know, certainly don't mind someone drawing tickets, but they don't need them to, most of them. So, you know, it's kind of, I guess that's a long way of saying it's a little bit more about, like, the leverage that you have in that specific situation. You can certainly make a lot of money supporting, but in these specific situations, the tours were so big and established that, you know, he wasn't going to make as much as if he just went out and headlined himself.
So I'd love, you know, if you can, you know, you don't got to give me the artist's name and the dollar amount, but I think it would be super helpful if there was a ballpark or a range, just so people understand what to expect. Like, let's talk an arena tour, like you just mentioned, of, you know, artists that don't need to sell tickets and the tour is going to sell out no matter what. Are we talking 200 a night, 2,000 a night to this opener, zero a night? Like, I just don't have any, I just love a range, a ballpark, something.
Yeah. So the short answer is, I will give you ballparks, but the short answer is something to factor here is, you know, how much can that headliner charge on their ticket price, right? Because, you know, if the average ticket buyer for Imagine Dragons is probably a grown adult, right? Like, it's probably people, you know, late 20s plus. You know, we even saw a lot of, like, you know, parents with their kids, and they were both fans of the band.
Yeah.
So they can charge a good premium for their tickets, you know. So something like that, they're a little bit more generous, and that you might get, you know, anywhere from 5 to 15 grand a night, if you're an act that's established and drawing some tickets. But I've had artists tour, you know, do arena tours and make 500 a night, you know, and those are the more like, oh, you're opening, you're the one of three, they took you as a favor because they like you, right? That's that kind of $500 to $1,500 or $2,000 a night slot. But those direct support tour situations where you're playing right before the headliner, you know, in an arena, you know, I think you can expect anywhere from 5 to 15 grand per show. And then, you know, if you have a ton of leverage and you're a really, really hot act, that's a completely different scenario. You know, like, if you're an act that's worth, you know, 5,000 tickets a night, but they just want to take you because they want to have an awesome show, I mean, they're going to pay what that's worth. You know, that's where you get into 30 to 50 to 75 grand per show. And that also happens.
Sure.
But that's a different scenario. That's not the, the textbook, like, oh, I'm going to open for so-and-so. And I, you know, I'm, as far as I know, right. I'm not worth tickets yet, you know?
So let's talk about the artists that, let's say, are not worth tickets, like you referenced, maybe at a club level or a theater level or something like that. What are the scenarios and the deals that you're seeing these days?
I mean, you know, it's all about how resourceful you are. Like, I've seen a lot of people, you know, I've seen artists never make it out of clubs and still have pretty successful careers. Yeah. There's not a lot of money in clubs regardless. You know, if you're headlining a club on a $20 ticket, if you're headlining a 500 cap, you know, you're going to make anywhere from $3,000 to $7,500. It's all math, you know, just depending on what your ticket prices are. But, you know, that, and those are like, that's if you sell it out, right? Like a sellout offer is what we would call it. But look, if you do, you know, if you're drawing a strong 500 tickets and you can do, you know, a late 20s ticket price, and, you know, you add merchandise and you add VIP, I mean, you can start to really dig your heels in and make a little bit of money. But you got to be resourceful and not spend it all, which I think is something that a lot of artists struggle early on is like, you know, well, if I'm hiring a band early on, you know, if the band isn't involved as like part of the project, but is a hired band, that can be a little tough because to the band, it's like, well, why would I cut you a discount when I can go play for so-and-so? I'm not going to reap the rewards of playing for little and then you blowing up. That doesn't help me because I'm just a hired gun. Whereas it's a little different if it's a band and every member is like invested in it long term. It's, you know, you're obviously not going to get to the end of the tour and demand money. You know what I mean? So every scenario is kind of different in that regard.
And in terms of support acts, how does it work differently for a club level support act who, let's say, is not worth tickets necessarily? Let's say the tour is going to sell out at the club level with the headliner. They need support. How does that work typically?
So if it's not going to sell out at the club level, usually I would encourage paying a little bit more money and getting someone who, you know, let's say you're in a 500 cap room on average, and you don't know if it's going to sell out or not. If you have that intuition that it couldn't, I would say that's where you take a little bit less money as a headliner and invest that into taking someone that's worth tickets and creating a big show. Because at the end of the day, the headline numbers that go into Pollstar and all these systems are based on the headliner, right? So like if you bring someone out and they draw 100 tickets a night, but you draw 400, that's a big W. That's a great win, you know? If you bring out someone who's worth 5 tickets and the tour does, you know, 300 tickets a night because it doesn't have a lot of buzz around it and the marketing's not there and multiple artists aren't marketing it, you know, that can end up being counterproductive, even if you make more money.
So you're from the, you grew up in the metal scene. I'm curious your perspective and your opinion on tour buy-ons. And for those of who are not familiar with tour buy-ons, it is a very controversial practice of headliners not paying their openers and support acts, but actually charging their openers and support acts for the opportunity to open the tour. And the opener, the money actually is flowing the other way, where the opener has to pay the headliner, you know, varies the amount, but they pay the headliner to open the tour. Now, I'm curious your opinion on that practice.
I mean, it's not a common practice. It's not, you know, something that I would necessarily suggest. I've seen artists buy onto tours and it completely return and be fantastic. And then I've seen artists buy onto tours and it was exactly what they expected and that the headliner didn't care about them as the artist because they were just the buy-on band. I think a lot of that is rooted more in like why the headliner needs the buy-on. If the headliner is just looking to make up for budget, says, I don't give a fuck, pick somebody, just make him give you $25,000 and we're not paying him, they're going to treat you a little bit differently than someone sitting down and saying, hey, well, you know, we need some help in some of these markets. Why don't we have this band buy on for $7,500 and we'll take the $7,500 and we'll juice it into marketing or whatever. So it's like,
yeah,
that's a little bit more advantageous for both people. And it's a little bit more artist friendly than just like writing a check. All that being said,
yeah,
you know, if you write a check early on in your career, it might open up some more doors. I mean, yeah. Do I think that that's ridiculous? Yeah, of course. But like, you know, if you have that funding and you come in and you write a check for an artist that you know you're going to gain fans from, no matter what, more power to you, you know. Mm-hmm. Just don't complain if you know, the headliner is not, you know, doesn't become your best friend.
Yeah. You brought up a really good point of how are they going to treat you? I think that's really important for every artist. You know, personally, I am extremely against the practice of tour buy-ons, only because I've heard so many horror stories, and I just think it sets a bad precedent, and I just think that, you know, artists should be paid to play, not have to pay to play. And I understand it's gonna be a personal business decision for anyone, and like, I get it when you say like you've seen some that return on that investment in merch sales or they gained a ton of fans, and like, totally that you know, but that's what every artist feels like it's gonna happen going into it. Now, I've heard the horror stories of artists paying, you know, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 for a tiny club level tour, and they are going on, you know, to five people in the room right when doors open. They play for 20 minutes and they play to five people at night. And because the tour's not selling, the headliner can't sell tickets, but also no one's getting there early. And it's just like, it wasn't worth it. You know, famously, this was about 10 years ago, the story broke. This Motley Crue, this is widely reported, Motley Crue charged their openers $1 million to open their entire arena tour, and they terrorized their openers the entire time. Not only did they make them go on before the doors open, start before the doors open, they had like the crew come out and spray the openers with super soakers full of urine. I'm not making this shit up. Like, this is like reported, but like, you're exactly right. Like, that's obviously the extreme, but like, you know, how are they going to treat you is like a really good point. It's just like, if you're the headliners are looking at you as like the buy-on band, then yeah, you're not going to get much respect. And I would really caution any artist against doing a tour buy-in just for that case alone. And it seems like it's a shortcut, and like, you know, God bless you if you got the funds, and good for you that you have a ton of money in the bank that you can buy on a tour. But I would just say that is a shortcut that doesn't tend to typically work out for the best, at least that I've seen in my experiences.
Yeah, man, it's totally. I've seen it. I've seen it be chopped up different ways and work. I've seen it be a disaster. You just kind of got to know, like, if you're gonna do it, it's a serious risk, you know. And it is not. Yeah. It is not normal practice, you know.
Yeah. And that's nice to hear from you saying it's not normal practice. You know, and I've seen people get creative, and it's, you know, it's not hard and fast. Like, I've seen, you know, openers that are going to jump in the bus with the headliners, and the headliners, essentially, they're participating in some of the expenses up front. They're still getting paid a guarantee to open the show per show, but they're helping with some of the upfront expenses, like a bus rental, like hotels, that kind of stuff. That to me seems okay, because it's like, okay, we're all in this together here. You know, let me open the books to you and let me just show you what's going, you know, to happen. But you get a bunk, you get this. And then in that instance, that seems far more okay to me than find your own transportation, your own lodging, and then pay us, you know, 10 grand. And then I was like, all right.
Right. 100%, dude. I've seen it be a little, you know, creative. And like I said, the digital marketing thing, I think, is pretty cool. You know, if you're going to have an artist buy on and you're going to put it into actually putting more people in the room, that seems pretty ethical. It's just, dude, every scenario is different, man.
Yeah. 100%. No, it's great. So speak to the artists out there right now who you know, maybe they are local heroes and they can sell a few hundred tickets in their local market. But maybe they haven't toured yet. They want to get on a tour. They don't know how to get support tours, but they can bring it live. They've proven that. Maybe they have, you know, some decent streaming numbers, but they really could not book a headlining tour right now. What do you recommend to those types of artists on how to get started touring?
I mean, well, first off, I would say if you're in that spot, that's a, you know, congrats. It's a great spot to be in. And you know, a lot of artists, you know, they kick off their career as hometown heroes, you know.
Yep.
And then they start to move out, branch out, you know, 100 miles north, 100 miles wherever mm-hmm. you are geographically. What I would say is keep building that hometown base. When I was in a band, mm-hmm. You know, my thing was, is we would try to open up for all the real tours that were coming into town and make friends with the bands and just be really genuine with them and, offer them a place to stay if necessary. I mean, we definitely did it. I think a good job when I was in a band of doing that and building that home base. And then, you know, at some point, as your team grows, you might want to get an agent. You might need a manager, whatever that is. But if you're starting off in your hometown and you're seeing a lot of success, then, you know, replicate what you did in your hometown somewhere else. You know, like, you know, if you're from Birmingham, yeah. I'll use a great example. If you're from Birmingham, Alabama, which is where I'm from, that's why I'm using that example. You know, sure. And you become a big artist in Birmingham. Okay. We'll do all of those same things in Atlanta. You know, find that promoter, open up for that show, pass out those flyers, the real grind and, you know, the real ground and pound. And if you can start to build it, you know, you really keep building it. And at some point you'll, you know, if you do all the things, if you do everything right and you're putting out quality music, then you're going to create a demand and it'll end up on someone's radar, you know, because agents and managers and labels and all the such, you know, we scour what's new and cool and we want to know who's drawing tickets in these towns. So, that's what I would say is replicate what you've done in your hometown, keep building it. And at some point you'll be able to hire someone that it's like their expertise, you know?
Yeah. When do you suppose, that's great advice and it's super practical and I appreciate you laid it out that way. And that's great. You know, I'm curious, how can artists go about, finding an agent, you know, like I got my music career started in Minneapolis and, theoretically a great music town. But you know, it's felt like an island. All my friends' bands, you know, they were drawn hundreds, if not, you know, 1,000, 1,500 tickets, and selling tickets to their shows, headlining, you know, First Ave, Main Room, all this stuff. And they couldn't sell tickets outside, but they also couldn't get any industry recognition because it felt like an island. And you know, I ran into this too, you know, years ago. It's kind of like, all right, can sell 800 tickets, can't get a response to save my life, or I don't even know where to begin. And so what is the steps? What do you recommend, I guess, for an artist? When are they ready for a booking agent? One, and if they think they're ready, how do they go about finding one? And let's use you directly. Let's say, you know, someone is resonating, like, man, Daniel would be such a great booking agent for me. Like how, when is the right time for them to approach you? How do they approach you? How do you want to be approached? And how does this work? Talk to an artist in Birmingham or wherever that they think they're ready for an agent. How do they get an agent?
So, there's kind of multiple answers to this because you might be in a spot as an artist where, you know, you are starting to see the, return on investment in your hometown. You want to start to go other places. Mm-hmm. You may not have any interest from like a record label or a manager yet, but maybe you're drawing tickets, right? That's where I would say, just reach out to them. You know, a lot of them won't respond, of course, but like, I usually say the number one mistake that people make when they reach out to agents is you just have to remember that agents are really, really busy, just like everyone else. And if you send them a book to read, you know, over email, and they're in the gauntlet zone of like grinding and like a long day or on a conference call, you just have to think about it from their perspective. Mm-hmm. Some of the best emails I've ever seen have been like, "Hey Daniel, I love your roster. We sound a lot like grandson. We just sold out our hometown. Here's our upcoming demo that's not released yet." Like, I don't really need to know that much more from the jump, you know? And if I listen to it and I want to know more, I'll ask. So that's one thing I'd like, you know, I think is keeping it precise with agents, and that goes for finding a label and a manager, etc. But I think it's definitely one of those things too, where like, again, though, if you have a manager and you're starting to be worth tickets, usually the manager can, you know, if they have relationships, the manager will help, you know, hold your hand to get the right agent. But yeah, I would just say like, create demand for yourself, and then be strategic when you reach out. You know, you just have to think about, you know, agents, managers, A&Rs, attorneys, they're all humans. So like, if you send them, an email at 2 a.m. in the morning, they may not, it might get lost because they woke up and they had, people that make them money emailing them. Right. So that's another thing, is just like, think about timing, think about what you're going to put in the email, be precise, create demand for yourself. Yeah. And again, agents, we're, you know, it's our job to have our ears to the ground. So like, you know, we're going to be scouring, we're going to be looking, and if you create demand for yourself, it'll end up on someone's radar.
Yeah. That's great advice. And that's super practical, advice. I want to just touch on briefly, because you're also the founder of Outlast Records. You're not only a booking agent, not only kind of the founder of this, the Continuance Foundation that we discussed at the top of the show. Talk to me about Outlast briefly, and kind of why you started it, what the mission is here, and what kind of artists you're looking for, if you are, on kind of how you're building this label.
Yeah, I mean, look, I've always had an entrepreneurial spirit. I mean, I think like the label kind of complements the agent stuff and vice versa. So it's enough inside my circle that it's not that much extra work. It's really more about like, if I find something I really like at the developmental level, we usually talk about it for Outlast, because Outlast hasn't signed anything like previously established, really. It's been very ground floor, you know, like my agent roster, I would be much more prone to like wait until they're worth a couple hundred tickets before I'm signing it. The label is meant to be a developmental outlet. So it's stuff that I really, really believe in from a small level. We're under Sumerian Music Group, which is Sumerian Records. And I have the freedom to sign stuff to that. And it's a lot of fun. You know, it definitely is like a total grind. It's a lot of work in terms of it's still inside my circle of what I do. But like, you know, I think where it really gets tough is, managing expectations too, with some of the artists that are, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, I'm not a magician, you know, I would like to consider myself a good agent. And I think I've set our artists that are signed to the label up for success, but there's so many things that the artist has to do also to break. So, it's tough, but I'm having fun doing it, and it kind of scratches my creative itch of being in a band, I think, for me to be able to kind of A&R the songs and the creative.
Yeah. Awesome. That's great. Well, Daniel, it's been such a pleasure chatting with you today. Thank you for being so candid with everything. I know everyone listening to this has really appreciated your transparency, all the practical advice that you gave. I know, people have really appreciated that. I have one final question that I ask everyone who comes on the show, and that is, what does it mean to you to make it in the new music business?
Cool. Well, again, thank you for having me. Anyone that talks the mental health gospel is a friend of mine for sure. So thank you. I think that having a career and, being able to develop artists that you're really passionate about and get them to the arena level and the stadium level, that's my ultimate goal, right? Is to have a clientele of, a certain amount of artists that can, go play the Rose Bowl or, be big enough for baseball stadiums but also like maintaining happiness at the same time and maintaining, work-life balance in some capacity, at least to the best of our ability. Keeping my brain healthy. I think, there's so many good aspects of the music industry to be in. The record industry is thriving. The touring industry is thriving. Publishing is thriving. I guess my answer is, to be able to have a career and represent artists that I really, really am passionate about and believe in on a big level. Also at the same time, be a good person.
Danny McCartney, thank you so much. This is great.
Thanks, buddy.
Today's episode was edited by Mikey Evans with music by Grassroots District and produced by all the great people at Ari's Take. This episode is brought to you by DistroKid. DistroKid is a distribution service that can get your music into all the DSPs like Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram. Over a million artists have used DistroKid. I'm one of those artists. I've used DistroKid to get my music out, distribute some of my songs. As you know, as I look into all of these distribution services, I test them out. And DistroKid is great. They offer a ton of features, annual fee, unlimited uploads, and you keep 100% of your royalties. Check out DistroKid.com.